Again, that's Cod, October 1st to the 29th at the Artist Property Theatre, 1515 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Hello, welcome to Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo. Today's guest is author William Ritter. William is the author of the new novel, The Dire King, released in August 2017. William Ritter, welcome to Between the Covers.
Hi, thank you very much.
Today we're talking about your new novel, The Dire King, the final book in the Jacoby series that Kirkus Reviews called a humorous, energetic, action-packed, and magical conclusion. So since this is the final book in a series, I'm going to ask you to give us a quick summary of the series and then talk about this book in particular.
Sure. The Jacoby series is a YA mystery set at the turn of the century. It is narrated by a young woman named Abigail Rook, who hails from Hampshire, England, and she has just found her way off the boat when the series begins, and she's trying to make her own way in the world, and as a woman at the turn of the century, obviously dealing with a lot of the social issues related to her own gender, let alone just surviving in the world at large. And she winds up finding work with an eccentric detective of unexplained phenomena named R.F. Jacoby. And Jacoby gives her the chance to have the adventures that she never got to have back at home, and gets to discover all kinds of worlds that she didn't even know existed within her world. And so that brings in the paranormal side of it. So it gave me just an excuse to tell lots of different folktales and mythology within the story, because I'm that kind of nerd. And so Jacoby is a seer. He sees things that other people can't see. And so along the way, he's revealing to her all of those kinds of magical worlds. So as the series begins, she's very unsure of herself, but knows that she wants to have that adventure. And over the arc of the four books, she's really coming into her own. So the second in the series is called Beastly Bones, and she gets a chance to use some of her own background knowledge. She has a background in paleontology and anthropology, thanks to her father, and that gives her a chance to sort of be the expert on the site. And then on into Ghostly Echoes, she's beginning to take steps without Jacoby. And then into The Dire King, she really rises as her own hero, the hero of her own story, rather than being someone else's sidekick. And so that's sort of the arc as a whole. Stakes getting larger and all that all along the way without revealing too much. So as The Dire King opens, they've gone from needing to solve individual little mysteries and murders and things happening in their own town to needing to save the entire world. So they've reached that point where there is, in fact, a dire king who's on the rise, who wants to do dastardly things. And at the same time, there's a lot of, and I'm not sure xenophobia is the right word for it, as it's sort of multiple different magical creatures in addition to other cultures. But there's a lot of that going on in the worlds where the magical creatures are often being turned against humans and humanity being turned against them. A lot of very easy metaphors to make, unfortunately, in this modern era. But along the way, they need to try and both defeat the evil and make sure that the evil is not compared too much with just the good, decent, magical, and human folks who just happen to be getting caught up along the way.
That was a great summary. As you mentioned, Abigail Rook, the main character and narrator, left her life in England where she was kind of doomed to become a proper lady and ended up in New England, where she becomes an assistant for a detective of the supernatural. So I work at a library, and at the library, I've noticed I've been getting more requests for children's books with strong female main characters. And the Jacoby series has just that. So why, as a male, did you decide to write from a female's perspective? And was that your plan before you started, or did it kind of come along with the character?
That's a great question, too. It was not my plan starting off. It was a much better idea than my idea. When I first began the story, I didn't think it was going to be a novel. It was just an idea I had in the middle of the night, and I jotted down some notes. And as I began to build more and thought of it as maybe a short story, I thought that I was being terribly clever. I have a degree in English from the University of Oregon, and I had read, you know, things like In Cold Blood, and Truman Capote was very clever writing that, and he wrote sort of himself out of the story as he was writing. It was his accounts of him going in and interviewing real murderers, but he cleverly wrote sort of about the reporter rather than writing about himself. And so I thought that I would do that with this series and write about this sort of creative, interesting, quirky, weird detective, and the person telling the story would be basically invisible. And as it turns out, that made him incredibly boring. And so the narrator was a boiled down version of me, about as boring as you can get. And so as it became a proper novel, that was still the setup. And it was suggested to me by a couple of people, including the woman who wound up becoming the editor for the books, that, you know, I might consider a female narrator. And so as just an exercise, thinking that was too extreme a change, I probably wasn't going to do it, but I thought I'd humor those suggestions and try it. And I changed basically nothing but the name and the pronouns in a full pass, and then went through the first couple of chapters, and immediately it was a better book with nothing but that changing. And looking back on it now, it seems stupidly obvious that the best heroes aren't heroes because they're super strong or they're super powerful. They're strong because of what they overcome. And if you're overcoming monsters, that's great. But if you're overcoming monsters and literally all of society as it's trying to push you down, that's a lot more. And so it became really easy to get into that character and get behind it. And then in the subsequent 7 or 8 drafts, I really got to know Abigail and got to really love writing that character. And she remains the closest to me. George R.R. Martin had a great response to the question. Someone asked him once upon a time for his Song of Fire and Ice series why he's able to write women so well. And he responded in his proper terse fashion, I have the radical notion that women are people. And it's true. I don't know how to write men and I don't know how to write women, but I know how to write people. And so Abigail responds the way that I would respond in that situation if I happened to be wearing that dress and doing those things.
That's awesome. That's really interesting. And you talked about this a little bit. She really goes through a lot of character development throughout the series. You said that you didn't really have... She was going to be invisible from the beginning, but then that obviously didn't happen. So she kind of evolved as you wrote the story and...
Yeah, I teach also. I'm a high school teacher and I've got kids of my own. And so a lot of the lessons that she's learning along the way are lessons that I know that my students need to hear. And they're not necessarily lessons that they've never heard before. Some of them are great cliches. The sort of haters gonna hate and let yourself be yourself are lessons they've heard a million times, but they need to hear a million more because we all do. And so along the way, it really began as just sort of, if I only got one book, if I only got one chance for her to tell her story, what would be the lesson that I would want to teach my students? And that was a big one. It's the repeated line in the first Jacoby book, that I've ceased concerning myself with how things look to others, and I suggest you do the same. And so she learns that in the first book, and the second book gets into encouraging her to be all of the parts of herself, not just to be herself, but to not throw away one part of herself, that you can be two things at once. And I learned that from my own family, that I've got family members who are scientists and also artists, and I've got a cousin who was a prima ballerina and a research scientist, and you can be both of those things, and you don't have to be just one. And then on into the third book, it became more important for me to encourage others to do the same, that once you've gotten to a point where you can be confident with yourself, then you can begin paying it forward and helping others be confident with themselves. And so there's some characters in there that give her a chance to really do that. And then, yeah, on into the Dire King, just having the courage to really fight for everyone and to trust even those voices that are not necessarily the ones that are closest to your own.
Well, Jacoby is a detective of the supernatural, and so he sees things that others cannot, auras and the true nature of humans and other creatures, and so his gift is both a blessing and a curse. How did you come up with his character?
My wife is completely to blame for all of that side of things. She is a marvelous creator as well. She's a great storyteller. And she had concepts of seers in the past. And I loved the way that she played with the idea. And so she had ideas of a seer as sort of an inherited trait. And that winds up being the premise of his story in the book, that it's this quality that shows up inside somebody. And they are otherwise a perfectly normal human being who just suddenly gets this ability. And what would happen if you were in that situation? And so she had played with the ideas more in a very classic sense, a sort of knights and kings kind of time when seers were a little more common, and sort of biblical times. You get mention of characters like Gad the seer is even mentioned in the Bible, of these people who can do these things. But then I liked the idea of playing with, well, if this was passed on as each dies, then what would happen along the way? What are the different time periods when you could play with that? And the turn of the century wound up being a really fun period to play with that idea, the idea of somebody who can see things in this sort of Sherlockian pastiche, the idea of if you were a turn of the century sleuth, what would life be like and what kinds of things would you discover? And so I took her ideas and played with them in my own world and really enjoyed what I got to there. And then bit by bit, as the story built, gave a little more background into what it was like for him to experience that, because that would be mind-altering. It would be a very strange world to enter into where you have to save people from things that they don't even know exist.
And they have a really great rapport, Abigail and Jacoby. They have this like witty banter, and just sometimes things that are really obvious to him would not be obvious to anyone else. So they have a really fun relationship. Yeah. So other characters throughout the series are all kinds of fantastic creatures. We have a ghost, we have fairies, gnomes, nixies, zombies, to name a few. Where did all of these creatures come from?
when I was at the U of O, I took a lot of folklore classes. I got a certificate in folklore, actually, over there. I didn't know what I was going to do with myself when I went to college. So it was really just an excuse to read as many stories as I could. And so that was my passion. That was what I did a lot of. And then when I began teaching, one of the first classes that I started to teach and that I've taught since was mythology. And so I love reading books that have a lot of that in them. And you see a lot of, you see zombie stories and you see vampire stories and even werewolf stories, but you don't see a lot of the sort of the diversity of cultures represented in YA Lit. And you're beginning to see more of it now. But I love the idea of getting characters that I've known about and loved and you know, people that I'm close to are aware of, but that you don't see in literature. So getting things like the Red Cap or the Nixie or things like that. I love Welsh and British mythology, but then I've also just worked in little bits from things that I know that my students have responded to from my mythology classes. There's moments of sort of Egyptian creatures and things like that you don't often have an opportunity to see. And because I was playing with a world that was built on world folklore as opposed to any one specific area, I could work those in my own ways.
Yeah, and you get a really diverse group of characters in the final book, The Dire King.
Yes.
What kind of rules did you establish for yourself when writing about these mythical entities? So, for example, there's a vampire, and you know, everybody has their own spin on the vampire. Right. Does it turn into a bat? Does it sparkle when it's in the sunlight? I mean, what kind of rules did you make for your creatures?
People give Stephanie Meyer a lot of flack for sparkly vampires, and that's fair. I try to go fairly traditional, but to be honest, Stephanie Meyer didn't make any bigger changes than Bram Stoker did. I mean, the fact that Bram Stoker made them suave and elegant was as big a shift from the original Romanian vampires as sparkles were to the Twilight series. So he is the vampire that I have in my series is very much a traditional Romanian vampire. So he is essentially a zombie. He's undead. He's gross. He's a little bit bloated. He's got blotches on him where the blood settled in funny ways, because that's what vampires looked like to the original storytellers. And so he follows a lot of those early rules, but I did play with it just a bit. And one of the ways I played with that is the idea that a cross is a good way to stop a vampire, that kind of iconography was important, particularly because Christianity wasn't always the only religion in the area. And in fact, Orthodox Jewry was very common in the area. So I mentioned that he, in fact, is a Jewish vampire. And so Christ is not an effect against him. He isn't hurt by the symbol of the cross. So little things like that, just playing with how the mythology itself was created. But my only real rule that I stuck to was treating each of the cultures with respect. And I guess that's kind of one of my rules for my mythology class, is you can look at things as how they're weird and how they're different and how they're funny and that kind of thing. That's fine, as long as you're not poking fun at that group and saying that one is more right than another and one is more real than another, that you can appreciate world religions and world folklore and world mythology, as long as you do so in a way that says they all have their own beauty and their own lessons.
Well, a lot of young adult books get bogged down in romance. Why did you keep the story romance light? And did you get any pushback from your readers about that?
especially after the first one, I got a lot of requests for ships. And I didn't know what that term meant, actually, when the first one came out, the relationship. I was completely stupid to that. So I saw one review talking about the lack of ships in the book and that they hoped that there would be more ships in the next book. And there's a steamer in the first book that she rides in on, but there's not really, they're inland. There's no reason for a ship in the second book. And I caught on eventually, but sort of like I tell my students, I want them to pick up lessons from the books that I often try to give them. And I find myself often telling students that it's really okay to be interested in romance. It's okay to be falling in love and giving yourself up for someone. But if you don't know what you're giving up, it's not romantic. It's stupid. Mm-hmm. And so she had to learn who she was before I was okay having her, you know, give herself up to some romantic interests. And she is able to. Yeah, it is a romance in the end. There is some romance to it, but it's not a romance that takes precedence over the other parts of her life. In fact, I think in good, real romances, you don't lose yourself to romance. You find yourself in it, and so mm-hmm. the person that you're with supports you and helps you be more yourself rather than having you lose yourself to them. And I think that's much more healthy than the Romeo and Juliet that we forced down students' throats as freshmen. I think that we can use a lot more role models who don't necessarily need that. And the other side of it was having Abigail and Jacoby not have a romantic relationship. I got a lot of folks who really wanted that, who saw the chemistry between them and wanted them to have a romance. And it became important to me to maintain that they were not and never would be in a romance, simply because it's okay to have a chemistry with someone that isn't romantic. And we don't see that often enough. We see, especially in sort of mainstream movies and things, you never see a female character interacting with a male character in a way that doesn't result in a romance. And that's, I think, to the detriment of society. I think there's lots of ways that women wind up getting pushed aside and often even deal with a lot of abuse because so many men are raised to think that the only way that a woman can have value is if they are a romantic interest or a mother figure. And in fact, you can have two scientists working in a room together discovering things that will change the world without them kissing. That can happen. That's okay. And so having the two of them have a really strong relationship that was platonic but very respectful was important to me.
For those of you just tuning in, we're speaking today with author William Ritter about his new book, The Dire King. Another theme that came up a lot in the book was bravery. My sister and I discussed the first book in the series, Jacoby, and there was a line that really struck her. Jacoby and Abigail are discussing Hatun, who most new Fiddleham residents kind of see as the town crazy lady. And Jacoby says this: "Hatun sees a different world than you or I, a far more frightening one, full of far more terrible dangers, and still she chooses to be the hero whom that world needs. She has saved this town and its people from countless monsters countless times. That the battles are usually in her head does not lessen the bravery of it. The hardest ones always are." So I kind of have my own read on that, but I'd like to hear what that meant to you and why you wrote it.
Yeah, Hatun is in a lot of ways very much the soul of the series. She's also the one character who is directly based on a real human being that I knew in my life. Hatun, spelled a little bit differently, was a woman who lived in Eugene, Oregon while I was attending the university there. And she was a transient woman. She was a woman who clearly had some dementia issues, but she was incredibly benevolent. She was a real woman who would appear sometimes at the library where I was working and would ask to see me. And I'd come out from the back where I was shelving books, and she would just warn me that I was near the cameras at the university bookstore and to watch out because that's how they get you. And I would thank you very much, Hatun, for looking out for me. And she would warn some of my coworkers about when the flu was going around, it was because they were putting it into the third floor women's bathroom and so to not use the stalls up there. And thank you, Hatun, for looking out for me. And she was that kind of a person, that there are plenty of people dealing with really hard issues, dealing with dementia, dealing with problems, who handle it in many different ways. But for her, she was never violent. She was never a menace to anyone. And in fact, it was just the opposite, that she saw a world that needed her to help it. And so she did. And at one point, she was throwing away copies of the Eugene Commentator because of the picture on the front of a little cartoon picture. And she said that the children at the hospital were being born with cartoon eyes. And I want to be the kind of person who, if I perceived a world in which it was even remotely possible that babies were suffering because of my inaction, that I would act. regardless of what other people thought of me. And that was her to a T. That was Hatun. So she was in many ways an inspiration for the character that Jacoby then takes on. And so Hatun shows up as a side character in the story. It's just an homage to that woman, to Victoria Hatun Adkins. And she then carries on that message for everyone else, that it's okay to do what's right, even if the rest of the world isn't recognizing it.
Well, another instance that stuck out in the book, in book 3, Ghostly Echoes, was the introduction of the character Lydia Lee, who is a woman of color who is transgender. And Jacoby comes to her aid as she's being attacked by a group of men, and Abigail Rook later says this about Miss Lee. She could avoid a whole lot of trouble and act the way they want her to, but she chooses to be herself. That's brave. Also, kindness is an act of bravery, I think, just as hatred is an act of fear. So this was a really powerful scene, especially given our political climate right now. Why did you choose to include this character in the book?
That one, in a big way, was for my students also. I've had a handful of students whose heart and souls I hope to pay homage to in that character. One in particular, my first year teaching, I had a young student who identified as male but preferred to dress and act female and in stereotypically female ways, and was just a marvelous human being. And at one point, I was working with another teacher in a different room and heard a group of kids from a different program walking through the hall, just speaking all kinds of horrible transphobic, nasty slurs and just terrible things in the hallway, and ducked my head out. And sure enough, they had been saying this right to the student's face and then continuing on their way. And I ran down the hall after them and just gave them a piece of my mind and tore into them about how I would personally be pursuing their expulsion if I ever heard that kind of hate speech on campus again and all that. And then turned back to that student asked if they were okay and checked in. And their response was to sort of be surprised to even have had me asking. They said, yeah, of course I'm fine. That's not the worst I've ever heard. I've heard a lot worse than that, and I'll probably hear a lot more again. And that moment was just eye-opening to me, that, of course, I respected tremendously the strength of character that student showed in being able to handle themselves so much early in the face of what would just cripple many adults. But it also broke my heart that so many young men and young women and young gender-neutral kids growing up don't get the chance to be defended and don't get the chance to have their own identity validated. And so often, unfortunately, even with the way society is going right now, we often see just the opposite, that their whole identity is often used as an insult so often. And so I wanted Lydia to represent that, to represent the kind of strength that you see in that, that you can have great strength in being kind even. And that character, Lydia, is kind to those people who were attacking her, is very patient and understanding even to those who didn't show her the same kindness. And that is a much greater strength than just fighting than using a sword and using a fist. It's a tremendous strength.
Absolutely. You wrote a recent blog post where you addressed a reader's concern about Miss Lee's character, which I would highly encourage listeners to read it, as it was very gracious and eloquently written response. What kind of feedback did you get from your readers about this character?
I have had one or two write that for their own personal beliefs, they've decided to stop reading after that book, that because they were opposed to it, they've decided to stop reading. And on just the opposite side, I've had readers tell me that they were reduced to tears, that reading that section was the first time they had ever seen a character in popular lit defend someone's gender pronouns, and that's powerful. And I understand and respect for those people who need to not be reading that, if that's not what they're interested in. I understand people who need to not read it simply because they don't like the writing. But I see that there's a perception that in the world right now, we've sort of got people who have a religious background, particularly a Christian background, are generally opposed to these sort of different gender identities and sexual identities, and that there's this niche world of sort of the LGBT plus world that embraces it, and that if you're writing something that embraces that and is respectful to it, you're only really appealing to the niche. And actually, I'm seeing just the opposite. I'm seeing that, in fact, there is a massive part of the world, in the Christian world and the atheist world and everywhere in between, that embraces all people for being who they are, and that, in fact, it is a much smaller niche that rejects it, and it's getting smaller every day. And so I wasn't writing a hugely political piece. I wasn't writing anything that was meant to be groundbreaking. It was simply a character existing in the world, just like my student existed in the world. And if a human being existing is offensive to you, then the problem isn't with them. So I feel confident in the choice to include that character and glad that I did. I was nervous, actually, when I first included her, because I had not cleared it with my editor. I had sent a very, very detailed outline that did not have that character in it at all. And I was, at the time, a little nervous that it might cause a problem, and shouldn't have been. And in retrospect, my editor is amazingly a strong advocate for LGBT and just all minorities in general, is a strong advocate for diverse lit. But I'm all the happier that I did, all the happier that I made the choice to include it, because those people who were offended and turned away at least got a chance to see somebody existing in the world, and those people who got to see themselves represented a little bit need more of that.
I agree, and we've talked about diverse books. We need diverse books and yes. things. And I think I talked about this with another author, and he had the main character of his book just happened to be gay. And I thought it was really neat, and I hope we can get there with some other diverse beliefs and things where that's not, like, the book isn't about that.
Yeah.
They just happen to, you know, be there because they're people interacting in the world just like people have always been. And so I hope we can get to that point sooner rather than later.
I got to meet with David Levithan once at one of the events I was at, and mentioned to him how much I love his writing. But I told him, frankly, I can't wait for the title of Two Boys Kissing to be the most boring title in the world. And he agreed, yes, absolutely. That's that we're waiting for that to no longer be a thing.
Well, you talked about that you're a high school teacher and you want to use your books to kind of teach lessons that you think are important for young adults to hear. If you could go back in time and give your high school self one piece of advice, what would it be?
I don't know. Probably just that you can, that those imaginary walls that you put up in front of yourself don't really exist. That if you want to write books, if you want to do whatever you want to do, you can, as long as you've got the passion and the drive to do it, you can make it happen.
Well, now that the Jacoby series has ended, what's next?
I am very excited. There's a project that is still very much in its infancy that I'm working on, and we're working on the last details just now today. Actually, I have some exciting emails in my inbox that I'm getting to move forward with Algonquin Young Readers, who have been an amazing publisher to be with, a fantastic house with just great editors. But it's a project that is very dear to my heart. It's one that I began the very first words of on the same day that I found out that I was getting another son in my family. So it's connected very closely to sort of the way families look, and that families are weird and they're strange and different, and that's okay. And that it takes a lot more than just blood to make somebody family. And then also about how we identify ourselves, who we are, and how we find out who we are on the inside. And this one, more so than lessons for my students, is very much lessons for my sons. I have two sons. And so it's a story about kids growing up and going off into the deep, dark woods and discovering their strength and courage inside themselves and their kinship with each other through that. And so it's, again, still very much in its infancy, but I'm hoping to have it finished and ready to move onto shelves within the next year or two.
Great. Well, we can keep up with your website, rwillritter.wordpress.com. Are there any other ways that readers can discover more about you and your work?
If you're interested in Jacoby, there is a very simple jacoby.com website that you can get information about the books and links to where to purchase it from mainstream or indie publishers. And I've got a Twitter account at willothewords. So if you are interested in following me there, you're welcome to, and I'm happy to respond to anyone.
Great. Well, I appreciate you talking to me. Before we wrap things up, is there anything else you'd like to tell listeners about your book, The Dire King?
It's coming out today. I guess I don't know when this will be airing, but it's out now on stands. I'm thrilled to be able to wrap up the end of this series, and I just hope that you enjoy it.
It's a really fun series, and even if you don't think you like fantasy or historical fiction or whatever your thing is, it's got a little bit of everything for everybody. And it's a really fun series. So
thank you.
William Ritter, thank you so much for talking with me today on Between the Covers.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Between the Covers. I'm your host, Bethany Grabo.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Artwork Rebels Tattoos for Harvey Relief event, Sunday, October 8th at 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Artwork Rebels in Portland. The Artwork Rebels Tattoos for Harvey Relief will be donating 100% of the funds raised to the Texas Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association by having fresh flash designs available priced from $100 to $200. Again, that's Artwork Rebels Tattoos for Harvey Relief event, Sunday, October 8th at 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Artwork Rebels, 528 Southwest 3rd Avenue, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Mr. Nana now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Don't touch my hair when it's the feelings I wear. Don't touch my soul when it's the rhythm I know. Don't touch my crown. They see the vision I've found. Don't touch what's there.